This episode is brought to you by Curie Briefs, the smartest 3-minute read in medicine. Think of it like mental floss for busy clinicians. Sharp, concise, and clinically relevant. Check it out today at Curie.md. And now, on to the show.
Welcome back to Curie, the podcast for healthcare professionals. Today's episode takes a step back, way back. With U.S. healthcare spending nearing $5 trillion a year, we're asking, what kind of system have we built? And what does a new drug pricing proposal from President Trump reveal about the way this system is structured, financed, and some would say designed to fail? Our guest is Dr. David Introcaso, a veteran healthcare policy expert, host of the Healthcare Policy Podcast, and someone who's been speaking about climate and healthcare-related issues for the past 25 years. In this conversation, we explore what's behind the ballooning costs, the perverse incentives, and the downstream impact this all has on clinicians. Let's dive in. Dr. David Introcaso, thanks for joining us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Let's start with the headline here, which was related to President Trump's recent executive order. For those that are unaware, earlier this month, he proposed what's being called a most favored nation or MFN pricing model. Essentially, the idea that the U.S. should pay no more for prescription drugs than the lowest price paid by other comparable countries. And by other comparable countries, they essentially mean countries with approximately 60% GDP per capita in comparison to the U.S. And actually, as a follow-up, just a couple of days ago, the Department of Health and Services even outlined target prices that pharma companies are expected to hit. So far, most analysts have called the move pretty controversial and realistically hard to implement from a legal and legislative perspective. But, you know, I think if we are to zoom out and think a little bit bigger picture here, I think there is more to this story than just drug prices. And so, David, I was hoping you could help us tease this apart. You know, what does a proposal like this actually reveal about the scale and about the structure of the U.S. healthcare market? Why is this market so big? And why does it feel so increasingly fragile?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it. You're right. This, I found, as you suggested, this EO, particularly executive order, particularly illustrative or telling, because drug pricing really, in a sense, serves as an excellent example to understand larger issues in healthcare delivery and cost or payment. So again, as you noted, this is this most favored nation pricing suggestion. This isn't a new idea. Similar related ideas, comparative pricing, have been around for a long while. But again, it's interesting for many reasons. First and foremost, obviously, as your listeners may know, we spend an immense amount on healthcare in some, but certainly as well on pharmaceuticals. So U.S. drug spending, interestingly, exceeds spending for all other countries combined. We spend more on drugs than all other countries combined, in part because they're so expensive for us. In fact, U.S. drug prices are about roughly three times what EU countries spend. So just on drug, and drug prices about 10% of total healthcare spending. But just think about it from a perspective of lost opportunity costs. Because we spend so much on drugs, that's money we can't spend on other things. Not surprisingly, because we spend so much, the pharma industries one might say, fantastically profitable, margins about 40% higher than the S&P average. So in isolation, you could say there's sound reason for this. But this begs all other sort of problems in healthcare. For example, we know relative to drug prices, 50% of patients don't take prescribed meds as directed. And this comes at a substantial health cost. Non-adherence is estimated to cause about 125,000 deaths annually and a good percentage, upwards of 10% of annual hospitalizations. Relative to your point, Andrew, criticisms, I think you're right. There are some implementation problems or hurdles, but the classic criticisms you heard in response, I think it was May 12th, this EO came out, are classic, and the listeners should recognize these. So the classic complaint here is that it will compromise access to healthcare, timely access. You hear that frequently here, to medications, and of course it will undermine drug innovation. These criticisms are really formulaic, and generally in healthcare and in other sectors, this sort of political rhetoric almost always constitutes one or the other, either fear-mongering or demagoguery. In fact, for your listeners, a good work to understand sort of this debate in the political sphere is Hirschman, Albert Hirschman's The Rhetoric of Reaction. And I would be remiss, lastly, just on point relative to drug pricing policy. The White House had an opportunity here, which they obviously ignored, to address really important attendant or related problems. That is the drug shortage problem. We've had a longstanding, almost now chronic drug shortage problem on important, say, cancer drugs and others. And the other point, relative to the pharma industry, is the pharma industry has a substantial, produces a substantial amount or accounts for a substantial amount of carbon pollution. And just to give, and I note this because there's just out a Lancet Planetary Health article on industry greenhouse gas emissions, and it concluded that the pharma industry's emissions have grown 63% faster than overall global carbon emissions. So the industry becomes increasingly, as it grows, also increasingly carbon polluting. So I would leave it at that on point relative to pharmaceuticals.
You know, earlier you'd mentioned how the U.S. spends almost three times the amount of other developed nations in terms of their drug pricing. Can you talk a little bit more about why U.S. healthcare prices are so out of sync with the rest of the world? And what does that tell us about how competitive or non-competitive our healthcare market really is?
Well, there's a lot there in that question. I'm glad you brought up the competitive issue. The healthcare market is largely non-competitive. The weedy answer to that is, if you look at, and speaking of, mentioned Albert Hirschman, it's the Herfindahl-Hirschman Index, and this is a quantitative index used by Department of Commerce, DOJ, and these are HHI scores, and the higher the score, the more concentrated the market is. And if you look at the healthcare HHI scores, they're very high in the thousands, which is to say there's very little competition in healthcare, particularly in urban areas. And of course, absent competition, and you could say there are legitimate reasons, there's high barrier to entry, other reasons, but that is the case. So there's little competition, which makes it difficult to have any market, any pricing competition in a market. The other issue is we have in the U.S., we have substantial price distortion. Okay, the noted, now deceased, sadly, Princeton economist Uwe Reinhardt used to say, the greatest healthcare in the world costs twice as much as the greatest healthcare in the world. And he had a great sense of humor, but obviously what he meant was you could pay for a certain medical procedure in one hospital in a city and go to another hospital 5 miles away and pay two or three times as much for the same procedure. the meaning of price distortion. In fact, pricing is a large part of the problem. And in fact, he and Uwe and your listeners may know Gary Anderson in 2015 in Health Affairs published an article I most everyone I know has read, and it had the known title, "It's the Price is Stupid." So that's a whole other conversation relative back to market size. It's really hard to grasp, but the U.S. healthcare market is immense. It's U.S. healthcare is the largest industry in the world's largest economy. It has a market cap only exceeded by the GDP of two countries, and the market U.S. healthcare market cap is north of $7.5 trillion. U.S. healthcare spending annually at about $5 trillion accounts for roughly half of all global healthcare spending. And what's particularly odd about it is, now, of course, I just explained pricing has a lot to do with it, but nevertheless, it's $5 trillion, despite the fact the industry provides care for just 4%, I think it's 4.2, 4% of the world's population. That's not excessively disease burdened. So we spend, in fact, at a per cap, it's about $15,000 per cap. So the first conclusion, and it's obvious that you can draw from this amount of spending, and I'll just make two or three points here on this, is healthcare is notoriously wasteful. And in fact, so wasteful that roughly of that $5 trillion, $1 trillion the U.S. Americans are forced to spend on healthcare services that don't improve anybody's health status. So we basically burn $1 trillion for really no legitimately good reason, certainly not to improve, again, anyone's health status. There are attendant problems because the market is so large. Because the market is so large, it's heavily financed, or otherwise phrased, highly leveraged. So that means investors have a huge role, and this leads to the term financialization of the market. And when you talk about financialization market, you mean healthcare is increasingly managed like any other profitable market commodity, which is odd, at least in because most hospitals, at least, are nonprofit. But regardless, it's seen as a tradable market commodity, and this in turn creates endless ripple or effects relative to access, coverage, safety, quality, and other delivery and cost problems. If you're just thinking of it as a tradable for-profit market commodity. And then the last point I would make, and this is more my own parochial perspective, you'll frequently read healthcare margins, particularly hospital margins, are nil or negative. And in fact, if you read MedPAC reports on Medicare fee-for-service hospital payments, they show, last year, they showed a negative 13 on balance margin. And this is really accepted as gospel, you know, nil or negative margins in the industry. But, you know, my question is, how is this possible, again, or rephrase, how is it possible that we're spending $15,000 for every 340 odd million Americans, and we're not spending enough? That just seems just really hard to understand or accept. In fact, I was reminded when we were prepping for this, Andrew, listeners may not know, this was Joan Robinson in the 1950s, and she had this great comment. She said, the purpose of studying economics is not to acquire a set of ready-made answers to economic questions, but to learn how to avoid being deceived by economists. So here, if $5 trillion isn't enough, I think people should revisit Joan Robinson's comment on economists. So I'll leave it at that on pricing and healthcare market size and some of those implications. I'm happy to talk about the next big question if you'd like, and that's the federal government's role in all this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think it's fair to say, and fair to criticize the U.S. healthcare market as being overcapitalized and highly leveraged, and the general volume of spending seems to mask a lot of these underlying inefficiencies. But yes, I would actually like to talk a little bit about the federal government's role in all of this. Obviously, the federal government is a major buyer or payer of healthcare through, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, the VA, various government subsidies. In your view, does the federal government, almost as a market maker, enable some of these current dysfunctions?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no way not to immediately run to the and think about run towards, you know, where's the federal government? Where's federal government policy in all this? Let me just make one last point about prices. This is an important, I think, an important point or concept to understand. I'm sure you've heard, or listeners are aware, that prices are termed inelastic or elastic. Inelastic means that demand for the commodity or whatever persists despite rising prices. So needless to say, intuitively, you would think, well, healthcare prices are inelastic, meaning particularly if you're sick, you know, you need a surgery, whatever the price is, you'll get the surgery. However, the inelasticity of healthcare prices, I think, is increasingly begged because of affordability. And you may know, and the Federal Reserve does this study, I think, possibly annually. So I looked at the 23 Federal Reserve study and found 27% of adults skipped some form of medical treatment because of unaffordability. So prices are becoming so, and some may call it actually predatory pricing. Prices have become so high, back to drug prices, and non-adherence to prescribed medication, more evidence, this is holding, the inelasticity of prices is holding less true. And this begs, and this is particularly problematic, and this paradox has been attributed to the UK physician, Julian Hart. So this known as the Julian Hart paradox. Those who need healthcare the most have the least access to it, or rephrased, have the least ability to afford it, even with coverage. All right, so I do want to make the point about prices. On the federal government's role, you're right, Andrew. I mean, starting with, and this is still true, this definition has been attributed to a White House official going back to the early 90s. And the government and the definitions, the government is defined as an insurance company with an army. And that's still largely true. I mean, if you look at healthcare spending and DOD spending, that's most of, and of course you exclude financing the debt, the $37 trillion debt, the government's still mostly an army and an insurance company. An insurance company meaning health insurance. So you're right, as you noted, when you think about Medicare, Medicaid spending, you mentioned the VA, you know, Affordable Care Act subsidies, and you throw in, often ignored, is the private insurance tax exclusion, meaning employer coverage. Spending for employer coverage is pre-tax dollars, so it's not. That's about easily about $300 billion a year in subsidy. Essentially, the entire healthcare market is explained by the federal government, effectively, and that's why, of course, the phrase Medicare is appropriately termed the market maker. So whatever, you know, Medicare say spends for something or covers something, the commercial market typically falls in line. So now we're talking about legislation and regulation. You know, the obvious thing to say about the Congress's ability to, let's say, effectively, credibly legislate healthcare is it's challenging, to be polite, because guess what? The healthcare industry is the largest high-spending congressional lobby. So that's not a surprise probably to anybody. So needless to say, it makes it difficult, to say the least. On the regulatory side, I think the same question or kind of question is begged. You know, to what extent regulatorily is HHS, to use the phrase, still fit for purpose? So there are numerous examples. Beg the question, I'll note Medicare Advantage, which has been in the news increasingly. It's always in the news, but maybe more so late. And that is Medicare regulatory forms concerning coding intensity or upcoding and financial benchmarking. Legislative to improve those issues or correct, throw in prior authorization, other issues, you know, related legislation has been lagging for decades. So let's just say the federal government's success has been, I don't think you'd have too many people criticize, has been modest, say, at best.
I think we've kind of been dancing a little bit around this issue, and I want to address it head on, and that's the topic of efficiency versus effectiveness.
Right.
And I think for a lot of our clinicians listening at home, you know, one of the most frustrating aspects of the system is feeling of waste. You know, the various administrative hurdles that they have to jump through, the hours spent billing on prior on billing or even prior authorizations, and all of these inefficiencies that kind of make it harder to actually care for patients, you know, unnecessary tests, peer-to-peer reviews, and so forth. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, from a systems point of view, how should we think about efficiency versus effectiveness, and efficiency in spending versus effectiveness in care delivery?
You know, I think the first thing we should do is not confuse the two or blend them. You know, the poor cousin here is effectiveness. We spend a lot of time talking about efficiency, specifically spending growth or spending efficiency. In fact, I just interviewed a Hopkins, Melinda a Button, in late April on my podcast. She just published a brief essay called The Value Zeitgeist in NEJM, New England Journal, earlier in April. And the good news is, as it relates to spending efficiency or spending growth, we've made progress, meaning we're more efficient, or spending growth has leveled off. And that's typically measured as a proportion of total national spending or the GDP. So for the last 15 plus years, healthcare spending has constituted 17% of the GDP. And if you can maintain spending at or below GDP growth, then you're pretty much don't have much of a problem. So if the economy continues to grow and spending doesn't eat an increasing percent of spend of GDP, then that spending is sustainable. Okay, so that's important. Now, why is that? We're not altogether informed, but what we do know is that it's largely a result of stagnant or negative inflation-adjusted payment rates. So payment rates have increased at or below inflation. So that in turn means we've improved spending efficiency. That's the bottom line, despite your comment, Andrew, about the bureaucratic aspects of actually delivering care or the bureaucracy involved in the clinical practice setting. The more importantly, I would argue, is, okay, what does it matter to be spending efficient if your outcomes are mediocre, let's say? And that's the effectiveness issue. And effectiveness is entirely a different matter, and it gets insufficient attention. So when we say effectiveness, again, we're largely talking about achieving or improving healthcare value, which, you know, textbook is defined as outcomes achieved relative to spending. All right, so what does it mean if we're more spending efficient, but we have LBW, low birth weight babies, we still do too many C-sections, too little prenatal care. You know, what does it matter if it's efficient but not effective? The problem with healthcare in this regard is that, in my view, we spend way too little attention as it relates to value. We don't do a very good job measuring for value or outcomes. We have a lot of process measures, but not really outcome measures. Per my example, you know, how many births per say 1,000 or normal delivery, prenatal had the mother had prenatal care, and it was vaginal birth, for example, you know, measuring outcomes. Now ACOs, affordable care organizations, were sort of designed. The intent was to try to improve value because they have financial benchmarks. The problem with ACOs, beyond the fact that the ACA never had a provision in which they should be legitimately evaluated, is that their financial benchmarks are not valid counterfactuals. It would take some while to get into that, but just to say, we don't really know. And we cannot know if ACOs, if they may be becoming more spending efficient, but we don't know if they're more effective improving healthcare. So that is a real problem. And there's no other industry, certainly no other major industry, that doesn't obsess about generating value. Now, it's more difficult in healthcare, certainly. I think we do a much better job regardless. I will make note of Michael Porter. He's the Harvard professor. He's been on this value issue for decades. In fact, he's largely responsible for the creation of ICHOMS, the International Consortium on Health Outcome Measures. And they've now produced health outcomes for, I don't know how many major disease conditions. ICHOMS is not widely used or recognized, unfortunately, in the US. I think they're more successful, or the use of their measures are more successfully used or more prevalently used in Europe. But that gets to the point of trying to do, we need to do a better job at achieving value. And I'll just bridge to discussing quality, value, quality. Certainly, you could say two sides of the same coin. And to reemphasize or value, if it's partially at least defined by quality, the Commonwealth Fund puts out this mirror report on an annual basis. You know, it's sort of a takeoff on, you know, mirror on the wall. And basically what it does, it compares, I think there's 7 or 8 domains. It compares U.S. healthcare or healthcare performance against 9 other or 10 countries and some that are comparative or rich countries like our own. And not too surprisingly, and I'll read from the 24 report, his conclusion, quote unquote, the U.S. continues to be in a class by itself in the underperformance of its healthcare sector, which was a polite way of saying that once again last year, the U.S. ranked last amongst 10 rich or comparative countries in performance. Not to say that the Commonwealth report is the be-all or end-all, but it's certainly, you could say the evidence is statistically valid, and it's certainly suggestive. The other thing I would have to fold into quality is health equity. Which is another sore point, and I could sum where we are in health equity very quickly by noting in 2019, JAMA published related quantitative research, and the authors of that publication, quote unquote, concluded there's been a clear lack of progress on health equity during the past 25 years in the United States. Going back to my mention of pharma's carbon emissions, I should note that here, because carbon pollution, first of all, the more we put in the air, the more deadly or harmful, because carbon emissions are a stock, how much quantity versus a flow problem. And carbon emissions, we know, far and away disproportionately harm minoritized populations. And this is really the definition of climate apartheid. So quality is not very good, equity is worse, and equity is made worse by the healthcare industry's carbon footprint, particularly for and beyond minority populations, of course, needless to say, the frail elderly, Medicare, and children, Medicaid. And one of the reasons for children beyond you know, faster respiratory rates, more time outside, not fully developed immune systems. Interestingly, it should be noted, children are shorter. They're closer to the ground, which means they breathe, because they're close to the ground, they breathe more polluted air. Fractionally, of course, but measurable. So, you know, the effectiveness side deserves a lot more attention, discussion, and work.
Yeah, this is great. And just to kind of round out our conversation about the U.S. healthcare's market size, because I think there's a lot of information there, and I want to make sure that we kind of underscore some of the nuances and granularities that we've just discussed. I've heard you say in the past that the U.S. healthcare system is winning a losing game, and I was hoping you could kind of just clarify what you mean when you say the U.S. healthcare system is winning a losing game.
All right, there's a lot of reasons for this to draw that conclusion. Let me just start with one that really gets almost no attention. And this is termed, and this is sort of wonky, this is the cost disease. Okay, there's an economist who's noted for this. We don't need to get into that. But basically, healthcare is like others, is a service-based industry, like say education. Okay, and because it's a service-based industry, it's labor intensive. Okay, and because it's labor and has to be labor intensive, most gains in productivity, because labor is your most expensive cost, are efficiencies in labor. But those labor efficiencies really can't be driven to any great extent in healthcare, again, because it's service-based, it's labor-intensive. So the industry suffers, per the economists, this cost disease, which means that as a result, that substantially helps explain why the U.S. service sector here, healthcare, is headed for, you know, again, the vernacular, a secular stagnation or zero growth. And to add to that, the sort of more common discussed metrics are, you know, the number of hospitals, you know, hospitals, just to say, needs to say a large percent of healthcare spending. Hospitals have been, the number of hospitals have been declining for decades. Nobody sees they're going to grow. And I mean, there's legitimate reasons, telemedicine, you know, outpatient surgery, et cetera. Annual hospital admissions have largely peaked. Aggregate in and outpatient demand has been relatively flat for years. So these other, you know, length of bed stays, there's all sorts of ways to slice and dice and understand performance. Let's just say those statistics in sum from a market growth perspective are not encouraging. You throw in several other things. It's maldistributed healthcare delivery, right? So this is why you have health profession shortage areas under HRSA. So there's substantial maldistribution. There are other sort of market problems. So while, you know, over the last, I mean, the growth of healthcare has been significant, stupendous, substantial, if you want to phrase it, the last several decades, but, you know, this can't go on forever. And then you throw in other headwinds. You know, this administration wants to cut $800 billion out of Medicaid. If this bill passes the Senate or the Congress, you know, has implications for Medicare spending. It's, you know, from a strict market perspective, it's not encouraging. Going back to climate, I do want to say that the industry in sum has a massive footprint at 600 million metric tons. And just let me make this point, just from a strictly market perspective, okay, healthcare's emission addiction or carbon addiction poses substantial financial risk. And this almost never gets discussed. But it will be an increasingly significant variable. And this is what the SEC climate-related financial risk exposure rule would have tried to address or correct. So just follow me on this logic simply, and we'll get through this. So the logic is simple. The climate breakdown, you know, the more emissions we put in the air, et cetera, the greater health harms are ensued or incurred, blah, blah, blah. So as climate breakdown persists, it generates increasing systemic risk. And this translates to property insurance risk. Now, healthcare is described largely by bricks and mortar because you have to deliver healthcare everywhere, so you have to have buildings everywhere. So you can't say we're not going to deliver healthcare in Florida, for example. So climate breakdown presents systemic risk. If or when property insurance risk cannot be absorbed or shifted, insurance becomes increasingly unaffordable. You know, you can't build anything, you can't maintain business or an operating building without insurance, okay? So insurance becomes increasingly unaffordable, if not unavailable. This in turn compromises other financial services. They increasingly become unavailable as well. Credit markets freeze, markets reprice, then you get into stranded assets, and climate-driven market failure is achieved. So, you know, the bottom line of all this relative to the environmental consequences of healthcare delivery, sooner or later you're forced to ask yourself, does healthcare, again, simply from a insurability perspective, whether or when healthcare falls victim to its own contradiction. And the contradiction here is, yeah, it provides healthcare, but at the same time, it generates a good deal of environmental harm. And you get into this cycle, which some people term a harm business cycle or model. And you're left to ask yourself, what happens in a couple of decades? Again, does healthcare, for this reason, insurability, ironically, one insurance industry impacting another insurance industry, causing it to be the victim of its own contradiction? So that's something to keep you up at night. In fact, let me just say, if I haven't put bore you to death, I did want to quote, and he's the Nobel Prize economist. He wrote a book with his wife, Ann Case, published in 2020. And this is Angus Deaton. And he said in his introduction titled Deaths of Despair, the healthcare industry, he's pretty blunt. The healthcare industry is a cancer at the heart of the economy, one that is widely metastasized, bringing down wages, destroying good jobs, et cetera, close quote. Again, back to as I opened, you know, we're talking here about massive lost opportunity costs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm glad you kind of connected to some of these wider macroeconomic issues, because I do think the healthcare system affects everything from wages to debt to national productivity. And there are broad economic consequences to our healthcare system. So I'm glad you brought that up. And I think it's a really fascinating and interesting topic for our listeners. You know, just switching gears a little bit, you know, I think a lot of people describe the U.S. healthcare system as broken, but you've made the case that it's not broken at all, that it's actually doing exactly what the system is designed to do. Can you help us unpack that a little bit further?
Yeah. I'm glad. Thank you for that. You know, that's actually a great concluding comment or question. You know, you hear, again, my view, I hear ad nauseum, you know, it's a system problem, or variations of that comment. Healthcare suffers from system failure or systemic problems, blah, blah, blah. You know, that to me is just an excuse. I mean, I don't think that's an adult responsible or a responsible comment that an adult should be making. You know, in theory, that I think, you know, there's a difference. I used to be the evaluation officer at the Agency of Healthcare Research and Quality. And the first thing I reminded myself of before I went in every meeting was there's a difference between theory and practice. And academics particularly are focused in about theory, but we're living in a world of practice. Okay, so in theory, it may be understandable, regardless of true, it may be understandable that there's system failure or that the failure is organizational wide, and maybe you want to call that a system. I mean, that I suppose is true. But in practice, there are really only people interacting, okay? And so whatever we have, whatever design or however healthcare is delivered, and we could call it a kludgeocracy, which it is, that's an IT term, kludgy or, you know, kludge fixes. Healthcare is designed with intent of individuals. So in that sense, it's purposely designed by people, and it's designed to achieve the intended, they're not guaranteed, but they're certainly intended results. And whether or not those results are achieved is irrelevant. I mean, there was an intention, however flawed, I don't think there are any perfect, efforts, but there's the people have made decisions. So for example, this is one of the classic miscues. I think it was Vermont decided to save money in Medicaid. They were going to cap pharmaceutical expenses per Medicaid beneficiary. And what they found out is they didn't save any money. It just increased spending because people, once they capped, they wound up in the emergency department being hospitalized. For my earlier comment about, you know, 10% of hospitalizations from people not taking adhering to the medications because they can't afford it. So the intention was we're going to save Medicaid spending and we're going to cap pharma spending. They didn't get there. Okay. In fact, they drove the opposite result, but they planned and intended to do it. So there's no magic here. It's really just an excuse not to be responsible. And I think that's the source point or reality of this all, is that we're responsible for every good thing and every bad thing that happens in healthcare policy, delivery, payment, however we want to slice and dice it. And knowing that, I would think we'd be a lot more attentive and careful, because again, this is healthcare, unless we don't even get into well-being. And HHS is supposed to be about health and well-being. But this is about people's living and dying and their freedom to actually have sufficient health to pursue whatever their interests are.
I think that's a great place to end. Dr. David Introcaso, thank you for joining us. This was incredibly insightful.
You're very welcome. I appreciate your listening.